Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
A diamond called the Koh I Noor currently resides as part of a crown in the Tower of London. But this diamond, which has 105 carats, has a long and bloody history, and ownership of it is owned, claimed by multiple countries. Anita Anand tells this story in her book, Koh I Noor. Good afternoon, Anita.
Good afternoon to you.
Could you start by describing the Koh I Noor to us? What does it look like?
Well, what it looks like today is not what it looked like when it came out of the earth. So right now, you'll see it if you go to the Tower of London. It's an oval-shaped, brilliant-cut diamond. It'll sit sort of in the palm of your hand. But when it came out of the riverbed of southern India, it looked a little bit like Arthur's Seat, if you've been to Edinburgh. Mm. This kind of jagged, rugged kind of rock, which was twice the size of the stone that you see now in the tower.
Right. Would it have been less lustrous and less diamond-like when it, in its original form?
Well, you see, it all depends on your aesthetic. So when it came out of the ground, it wasn't touched so much. It was sort of roughly shaped in what's known as the Mughal style. So it had great flat edges. It had a flat table at the top. Now, that the taste for diamonds was very much that in that era. It's only sort of really in the late 1700s, I think, that you start having these sort of kind of much finer cuts which start coming out of Europe. And so, and by the time, you know, it gets to England, that the taste is for the brilliant cut, the rose cut diamonds, these very sort of very chiseled, very faceted stones, which is what the Koh I Noor became.
So when it was originally found, what happened to it at first? Who was the first owner?
Well, it's the beginning of the Koh I Noor's life is shrouded in mystery. It's one of the hardest substances known to man, but the actual prehistory of the Koh I Noor is very, very shady. There are references to a diamond in an ancient Hindu scripture, which goes back 5,000 years BC, which talks about the Siamantica gem. It's the diamond, the gem of the god Surya, the sun god, which is meant to have these mythical powers of destruction. So mortals just are not good enough, aren't complete and perfect enough to hold this diamond without terrible catastrophes befalling them. But we really only get to hear about it in the reign of Shah Jahan, the Mughals era, when it was placed on top of this fantastic throne that the Mughals made called the Peacock Throne. Now, if you get an idea of how much this throne must have cost and how important it was, you've seen the Taj Mahal, even in pictures. I'm sure most of your listeners will know what the Taj Mahal is. The Peacock Throne cost three times as much as the Taj Mahal to make.
Crikey.
And it was this ornate, it looked a little bit like a kiosk for a king. So it had these pillars, which were meant to represent cypress trees and this great roof on top. And in the middle of these pillars would sit the Shah. And on top of that were two peacocks, all of this kiosk encrusted in gold, diamonds, rubies, emeralds, pearls. But at the top, these two peacocks sat, and one of the peacocks, its head was this massive diamond, the Koh I Noor. So that really is the first sort of recorded history that we have. And then pretty much after that, it's clear what happened to the diamond.
There seems to be, and this is a recurring theme in your book, that a lot of misfortune seems to befall people who either own it or are close to it.
I mean, really, honestly, if you're faint-hearted, turn your radio off now, because it is Game of Thrones territory we're talking about. People have stabbed each other, poured molten lead over each other's heads. They have mutilated each other's faces, poked out eyes, poisoned, bludgeoned, stabbed each other to death in the pursuit of the diamond and all that it represented, because it became much more than itself. It became a sign of omnipotence, if you like. Whoever held the diamond held the throne. And so it was really made, you know, it was coveted by the British when it came into the possession of a Sikh Maharaja who was, you know, again, the Game of Thrones thing, they talk about the King of the North. You know, Maharaja Ranjit Singh was the real deal. He'd united the whole of the north of India, the whole of Punjab, turning it into this complete fortress kingdom. And he would wear the Koh I Noor strapped to his arm, knowing full well that it carried this mythology of the curse, as if, you know, thumbing him his nose to the supernatural and mortal, saying, come get me if you want to. And nobody could touch him. He died peacefully in his sleep. But when he died, in the following 4 years, his son was poisoned. His wife was battered to death with bricks. His grandson was crushed by falling masonry. Another grandson was cut to pieces by sabres. Another was shot to death. As they all sort of tried to get hold of the kingship and the Koh-i-Noor, until the last man standing was no man at all, but this little boy, his youngest son, Duleep Singh, who then sort of falls prey to the British and is forced as a 10-year-old boy to sign over the Koh-i-Noor to Queen Victoria.
This part of the story is one of the Black Queen and the White Queen.
Yeah.
The White Queen being Victoria, the Black Queen being Duleep's mother, Jindin. What happened to her?
When every other challenger has been murdered, Rani Jindin comes back with her little son, who she's spirited away while all of this bloodshed is going on. And he is just he's a 5-year-old boy. And the court of Lahore says, oh, brilliant, we've got this 5-year-old kid, we can mould him whichever way we want, we can make him do what he likes. But Jindin does this unthinkable thing. She comes out of Purdah and she says, no, I rule with my son in my lap. I'm going to make sure nobody takes advantage of him, with the Koh-i-Noor strapped to his chubby little arm. But when the British sort of, they manage to do some deals with very pivotal people in the court, saying, betray your boy king at the right time and we will reward you. And the whole kingdom collapses from underneath, you know, Duleep's feet. The British then sign a treaty of friendship with the boy. They say, you know what, we come as friends, we'll stay for a bit, but we'll leave on your 16th birthday. And they sign this treaty. The only person warning against the British is Jindin, saying, don't trust them. They want everything. They want it all. And so the British take her away from her son. They sort of drag her away. They lock her in a tower. And she won't see him again for almost 20 years. And little Duleep then, you know, as this little boy, alone, without his mother, without any friends, without anyone there to protect him, is forced to sign over his diamond to the British. But she comes back into the story.
Weirdly, in the intervening period, he's sent to England, where he does strike up a relationship with Victoria.
A really loving relationship, actually. You're absolutely right. So when he's 15, and he's been separated from his mother by this time for 5-6 years... He's been put into the care of a Scottish couple who are raising him, and he turns to Christianity. I mean, they are devoted Christians. And then on his 15th birthday, he says, I want to see the Maharani of the world. I want to see this woman, Victoria, who I hear so much about. Victoria says, let him come. Can't wait to meet him, because she's completely enraptured by India. It's a place she's never going to see. It's part of her empire, but she'll never see it. But it's kind of embodied in this little Maharaja. Everyone talks about his beauty, how exotic he is, how polite he is, how mannered he is, how cultured he is. So she wants to meet him. And he's embraced in the court. You know, she treats him almost like one of her own children. And he certainly sort of starts to look upon her almost like a mother. But then Jindin comes back into his life. Mm. When, you know, so he's 21 years old, he hears that his mother is dying. And he sends her a letter, which is intercepted by the British, saying, Mother, how are you? And the British say, right, well, we can't keep them apart really anymore. It's just, you know, punishing this boy for something he hasn't done seems ridiculous. But we'll make sure it happens far away from Punjab, where she can stir up problems. And when they do meet, they vow never to part again. And from the moment she comes back into his life, she's dripping into his ear like a little slow poison. The Koh-i-Noor, they took the Koh-i-Noor, they took your throne, they took everything. That woman you think is your mother, Victoria, she has actually robbed you. And it does. It turns his head. So from one point, when he first comes to England, he looks at Queen Victoria like a mother. He ends up by referring to her as Mrs. Fagin, the receiver of stolen goods. And the whole relationship just implodes in a horrific way.
Who's the last British royal to wear that crown with the Koh-i-Noor in it?
So the last reigning monarch was Queen Victoria, who wore it. And she did so with a great deal of trepidation, because she'd heard all about the curse and the, you know, ocean of blood that had carried it over to her shores. And so she kept asking, sending letters to India, saying, are you sure this is not cursed? Am I going to be fine? To the point where the Governor General of India, a man called Dalhousie, is so fed up. He says, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, if she doesn't want it, bloody send it to me, I'll wear it. but Victoria does then get over this worry. The stone is recut, it's halved in size, it looks different. And she wears it until the day she dies. Even when she puts away all her other jewels after Albert dies, the Koh-i-Noor is the one jewel that she will still wear in public. But after she dies, no reigning monarch of Britain has ever worn that diamond. It's been in the Queen Consort's crown. I don't know whether the thinking is that, you know, your wife's expendable, but it has been the Queen Consort who has worn it since. And it was last seen on the Queen Mother's coffin because she wore it as consort. And now it's just sitting in the tower waiting. So I don't know, if Charles comes to the throne, we may well see Queen Camilla wearing it on her head if she dares.
Mm. You'd think twice about doing it, though, really, given its history.
Yeah, I mean, it just depends on your superstition, to be honest. I'll tell you what's more concerning these days, I think, rather than supernatural curses, which I don't particularly believe in, although, you know, they are so tightly wound around this story, and certainly horrendous things have historically happened around this diamond. But it's a diplomatic grenade, because India wants it back. They hate the way that a little boy was forced to sign a legal document that he didn't understand. The Pakistanis want it back because it was seized from Lahore, which is their city. The Afghanis want it back because Afghanistan was founded on the back of the Kohinoor. They think it's their gem. The Iranians want it back because it was part of the Peacock Throne, so they think they deserve it back. The Taliban have made a separate approach to the British, saying, we want it back. And I just heard, in fact, yesterday, Willie Dalrymple, my co-author in this, was at a function where somebody from Bangladesh came and said, well, we quite want it back as well. So it is, you know, it's become a symbol of colonial looting, if you like. And certainly for countries like India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, that has become a really burning topic, that if you can have cases for Nazi loot where things that were seized by the Nazis are returned to their Jewish owners, in the 1940s, why not the same rules for things that were seized in the 1840s? So I don't think, you know, it would be a tricky thing for a monarch to wear that in a crown, I would suggest. But, you know, stranger things have happened. Anita, and they're all in the book. Much stranger things have happened.
Indeed. Anita Anand is a BBC broadcaster and co-author of Kohinoor, the story of the world's most infamous diamond. Anita, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you.
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big cheque for the delivery guy? Gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.